Item 110, please.
Amend the Building Demolition Code to implement Senate Bill 871 and add dust and site control requirements for residential demolitions. Amend fee schedules.
Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. Colleagues, I'm very pleased to be bringing this to you today. Lead-based paint and lead-contaminated dust in older buildings are the most common sources of lead poisoning. Children younger than 6 are especially vulnerable to lead poisoning. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, 535,000 children have blood lead levels high enough to damage their health, but lead poisoning is 100% preventable. That's why I supported this policy work at BDS, and I'm bringing it forward for consideration today. Dangerous asbestos and lead-based paint can spread to neighboring properties during demolitions. In 2016, Council passed an ordinance requiring homes and certain other buildings built in 1916 or earlier to be deconstructed rather than demolished in order to keep reusable materials out of our waste stream and toxins out of our air. Unfortunately, this left significant areas of our city, such as East Portland, with little to no protection or benefit because so many of their buildings were built after 1916. This ordinance fixes that unintended consequence by protecting all residents equally. In 2017, the state legislature, led by Speaker Kotek, Senator Dembro, and Representative Kenny Geyer, enacted SB 871. The legislation does two things. Number one, it allows cities to require a copy of the asbestos survey. And number two, it directed the Oregon Health Authority and DEQ to develop a menu of best practices for addressing lead-based paint. This ordinance adopts some of the best practices that the Oregon Health Authority and DEQ developed for lead-based paint control during residential demolitions, and it requires a copy of the asbestos survey to be provided to BDS. The process to develop the ordinance was thorough. BDS, other city staff, and many stakeholders participated in the state's advisory committee that developed statewide best practices. Many of those same agencies and stakeholders concurrently participated in BDS meetings to develop this ordinance. The cooperation and collaboration among all the parties made the process efficient and the policies stronger. I'm going to save my further acknowledgments and thank yous for the conclusion of the hearing and turn it over to Nancy Thorington to walk us through the details of the ordinance. Welcome, Nancy.
Good afternoon.
Nancy, can you turn that mic on? Sorry, it got turned off. There we go. Okay, thank you. Nancy Thorington for the Bureau of Development Services. First, I would like to thank Speaker Kotek's office and Senator Dembro and Representative Kenny Geyer in their efforts to get SB 871 passed. It's been a really good and productive process. Let me see if I can. There we go. These are some of the stakeholders, and I would in particular like to thank Perry Cabot with the Multnomah County Health Department for his efforts in this, and our Development Review Advisory Committee, our Subcommittee on Demolitions, and in particular Mary Helen Kincaid. She actually started getting these agencies working together several years ago to talk about some of the issues with the demolitions, and that transitioned basically into some of the things that are before you now, 871 and this ordinance. So I really want to thank everybody for that. It goes that way. Okay. So SB 871, as the commissioner just said, it basically addresses, there was a gap because there were no regulations for lead-based paint in residential demolitions. There was for asbestos, and so this allows basically, it required the local, Oregon Health Authority to sit down with DEQ and other stakeholders to develop some best practices, and it also allows jurisdictions to require a copy of the asbestos survey. Which it wasn't required previously. As Commissioner Udaly noted, we worked on a parallel track with Oregon Health Authority and DEQ, and that was really a very beneficial project, way of approaching it for everybody, because we definitely were able to bounce ideas off of each other and come up with much better best practices at the end of the day. So this is a summary of the ordinance itself. It applies to 1 to 4 family or unit structures, and the accessory structures that are over 200 square feet. The 200 square feet is what's required for a building code, so that's where we got that. We estimate that this is going to cover about 700 projects a year. That would be 300 single-family and duplexes that we currently have some regulations for, and then it would add the 3 to 4 units and approximately 300 accessory structures. There'd be about another 50 in the 3 to 4 units, so that's where you get the 700. It requires the best practices include creating a demolition plan for every site that outlines the dust and site control measures that would have to be done. One of the big ones would be removing all of the exterior painted materials. We talked through that quite a bit with the stakeholders, and it was determined that from the subject matter experts that removing the exterior materials was the most efficient way to do it. Obviously, will still be some interior painted materials, but with the other dust control measures like wetting down, we felt like that was going to cover it and make sure that everybody was safe. The ordinance also requires that the neighboring properties within 150 feet get posted with door hangers. Again, this was an issue that we discussed quite a bit. We talked about whether to go 400 feet, which is the farthest distance that uncontained dust has been found to travel in scientific studies. But we chose 150 feet because we said, well, we are doing dust containment, so we don't necessarily have to go out the full 400 feet if you're already containing it.
What's our current demolition door hanger?
Only the 10 surrounding houses. So this extends that, probably about a little more than double.
Okay, thank you.
Let's see. So there can't be any mechanical demolition if the wind speeds exceed 25 miles an hour. And there will be two additional inspections per project. Right now we only do a post-demolition inspection to make sure that the site has site control measures on it, and so this would add two more, a pre-demolition inspection to make sure that the demolition plan is adequate and correctly tailored for that particular project, and then a during demolition inspection to make sure that they're complying with the plan, and then again the post-demolition inspection to make sure that the site is secure. The pre-demolition and post-demolition inspections will be mandatory. We recently added a component that would make the during demolition inspection discretionary, and the reason for that was in talking with our site development inspector, he said that there would be some of the projects, because now we're including accessory structures, which we've never done before. So he indicated that there would be situations, for example, where if they go for the pre-demolition inspection and they're on site and all of the machinery's there, the wind speeds are under 25 miles an hour and everything's looking good, then they would have to, for let's say a 200 square foot, if you've got a garage or something and they've got all the machinery there and they're going to be doing it that day, then it wouldn't make sense. They would either have to sit there and wait until the project's underway, which could be 2 or 3 hours, in which case they can't do any other inspections, or they would go out and do the other inspections, and it would take them a couple hours, and by the time they got back, the site could already be demolished. So I tried to craft some language, that said, well, okay, maybe just an exception for accessory structures, but an accessory structure can be 1,800 square feet. So we didn't want to just say all accessory structures wouldn't have to have this during demolition inspection. And vice versa, you could have a small house. You could have a, 400, 500 square foot house. So we're you know, I couldn't really craft language in the ordinance that could quite cover it. So we're considering, you know, probably some admin rules that we can you know, take some time to look at. So that's another big piece in this. And one of the big incentives to comply with this is that we won't issue the building permit for the replacement structure until they already have the demolition permit finaled. And, you know, we had quite a few builders on our stakeholder group, and they said that that actually is a bigger incentive to comply than, you know, some of the fines.
Well, how did you pick 25 miles an hour for the wind?
That's just from the subject matter experts. That's pretty standard.
Thank you.
Oops. Put that in. So these are the enforcement mechanisms that we were looking at. Basically, we really want to focus on gaining compliance through outreach and education. I mean, we don't want to fine anybody, but, you know, we're going
to... Could I go back to Commissioner Fritz's question?
Sure.
What do we know meteorologically? How often is the wind blowing over 25 miles an hour?
I don't have that information. Because this is all brand new, we're going on what other jurisdictions have done. I know that, you know, for example, the city of Eugene, that's 25 miles an hour. All of the other cities that we've looked at, that's their point, and Oregon Health Authority and DEQ. So I would have to rely on the subject matter.
Is that based on science? 25 miles an hour is actually a pretty stiff wind.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's not an inconsequential breeze. That's a robust blow, as they say.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if there's science behind that or if it was an arbitrary.
That's a good question. I don't know. I really would have to rely. You know, we took that number based on, you know, because that's not our purview either. So we looked at what was already, you know, being done in other jurisdictions and what our subject matter experts.
I can share with you that 7.9 miles per hour is the average wind speed in Portland, and that kind of a normal wind range is 10 to 25 miles per hour, so it is on the upper end of normal.
And are the inspectors who, when they get there, they've got a wind speed gauge?
They will, yes. Yeah, I've been told that you can buy them for about $25 at Home Depot, so they're not, you know, anything that...
Is that the velocity at site, or is
yes.
it the current... Okay.
Yeah, we, you know, we tossed around the idea of whether to make it site-specific or, you know, you could look up, you know, on your cell phone, but because the conditions vary depending on where you are, we decided it was best to do site specific.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. So again, our compliance, we want to make sure that we reach out and we do as much education as possible. We'll be conducting lunch and learns and reaching out to the development community, talking to the Home Builders Association and others, and we'll go out to the neighborhood associations and do as much outreach as we can to make sure that everybody knows what the requirements are. And then once it goes live, the first step will be, if we find somebody out of compliance, they'll get a correction notice that basically says, hey, this is what you did wrong, this is what you need to do to fix it. And then if they still are out of compliance, then we have the ability to go in and issue a citation and fines. We've made the fines, you know, fairly significant, hopefully enough to, you know, get people's attention. The implementation costs, because we're adding two additional inspections, we would like to add two new site development inspectors who will be dedicated to doing just this. And basically, to fund those new positions, we're proposing increasing the permit fees by $180 per demolition permit. And then the door hangers were already, as Commissioner Fritz noted, we already do some door hangers, but we'll, instead of having 350 approximately projects per year, we're going to have, you know, upwards of about 700. So we looked at the cost, and basically it'll be about 300 per year. So that's not terribly significant. In summary, our recommendations are to adopt the ordinance, to create two new site development inspector one positions and hire for those positions, to amend the building and other permits and fee schedules to increase the demolition permit fee by $180 per permit, to amend the enforcement fee and penalty schedule to add the fines. And we are asking for an effective date of July 1st because we need to ramp up for this. This is a brand new program for us, so we have to hire those two new inspectors, which has to go through the city process. And we have to train them. They will be required to have asbestos and lead-based paint certifications, which are currently not required for our inspectors, so this is going to be something new. And then, obviously, we have to do our internal staff training, change certain computer programs to accommodate the new inspections, potentially create some admin rules. And so, finally, we will be looking to follow up. We'll monitor this as we always do with our ordinances, potentially adopt some administrative rules, and we'll be continuing to meet with the DRAC Demolition Subcommittee, and we propose coming back to Council in January of 2020 with a report on how it's going.
What would it take to expedite this? How can we speed this process up?
So I spoke with our HR person, our head of inspections, and our finance person, and they were the ones that gave me the January or the July 1st date. They said the hiring and going out for the process, the hiring process, long and short of it, hiring and getting the right people in there with the certifications and getting them trained would take that long. So. That's
what, and could you be a little more specific about the certifications that are required?
Sure. Yeah. So there is an asbestos certification, and I think it's a. I'm going to let probably Perry Cabot correct me on this, but it's a few day training on that, and then there's a lead certification that also is another few days.
Are there people on staff currently who we could get skilled up with those certifications so that we could speed the process up?
The issue is that we're already maxed, so they already are. We're hiring as fast as we can for other positions that already have been in the budget for a long time, and we have inspector positions that have been open for months and months. It's really hard because, the good news is the economy is doing really well, and so, the building industry is very robust right now. The downside is, all of the jurisdictions, include Portland and the whole metro area and the whole statewide, are trying to get the same group of people, for the inspector positions. And
Is there another way to think of this instead of looking for senior level inspectors with a broad skill set? Could we create a category of inspectors in the near term that are specifically trained to this skill set and not the wide range of skill sets?
So we're only looking for inspector ones. That's the lowest level that we can do, and we're bound, if they're going to go out and inspect a site, they have to have the state certifications. We can't circumvent that process.
Could we hire a firm that provides those skills while we waiting, pending us staffing up to that?
That's a good question.
I mean, BDS, we've done that before.
Yeah, that's
we
true.
We have used outside help.
Uh-huh, sure. We can look at those options.
Yeah, I'd be happy to contract in the meantime, but there's just an issue of a lack of qualified candidates because of how competitive.
And this will be a very specific set of skills in terms of they're going to have to know the erosion control side, because what we did on this was we were trying to focus on the dust control and the site control piece. There we're focusing on having them comply with the existing regulations rather than, you know, trying to create a whole new set of regulations. So the person would have to have that site control piece, you know, and then get trained up for the other parts.
Yeah, maybe there's a possibility to bring back some recent retirees on a temporary basis until we have the positions filled full-time.
Sure.
If I might just suggest that, yeah. Obviously this has been a priority for Commissioner Daly, and she's more anxious than anybody to see it implemented. So presumably we can set the implementation date of July 1st, and if any of these suggestions pan out, you could come back and say we're going to implement it, you know, set a new date.
Oh,
yes.
Thank you.
I hear the mayor saying that he wants us to start as soon as possible.
Understood.
And I
yes.
concur.
And the July 1st is not, you know, that's not a hard and fast deadline. If you could stand yeah. it up sooner, you could do that. This
I mean,
does
honestly,
not prohibit
what,
you.
What can yeah. we do in less than
right.
6 months in City
yeah,
Hall?
Yeah, I hear you, Commissioner.
I mean, we have to have an implementation date so people know that it's yeah. going to be by then, but we could always come back for, if they're ready at the beginning of June, come back with an ordinance to say implemented tomorrow.
In the meantime, we could kind of peer pressure people into safely demolishing
yeah.
their houses. I'm not opposed to that.
Well, in the meantime, it's probably going to rain, so it
will. Oh, yeah, yeah, it's raining, so.
Any other questions?
Not immediately, colleagues.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Nancy. It is my pleasure to welcome our special guests up next, Senator Dembro and Representative Kenny Geyer.
All right, special
guests.
Thank
you for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you very much, Mayor, Commissioners. Delighted to be here. You know, Representative Kenny Geyer and I are preparing for a legislative session that's coming up. We're laser-focused on looking forward. We're exhausted already, even though this has not started. But, boy, what a pleasure to be able to look back and see something that we worked really hard on actually come to fruition. And I have to say, I'm really excited with the program as it was described. It really fulfills what we were hoping for. You know, we've been working on this issue for several years now. And I want to say that this really is the culmination of a long process, but a process that really, it did it right. This is what government should be doing. This issue had its genesis, actually, in a monthly constituent coffee that I have, where some constituents, and, you know, I never introduced myself. Do I need to do that?
Yeah, why don't you do it for
yeah,
the record?
Yeah. I'm Michael Dembro. I'm the senator for District 23. That's Northeast and Southeast Portland. So I had some constituents from my district come and raise this issue of the health effects of demolitions if done wrong. And there had been conversations about demolitions and, you know, their impact on neighborhoods and livability, et cetera. You know, I was certainly familiar with that. But the issue of what happens when buildings come down that likely contain lead and asbestos, I hadn't thought about. You know, I promised them that we would see what we could do. And that led to what was then, I think it was 2015, mm-hmm. was it? Yeah. Senate Bill 705, which at the end of the day, it turned out that at that time, really all that we could do was asbestos. We wanted to do lead, too. Lead is a very serious problem. But just for organizational, bureaucratic reasons, the state agencies were not prepared to take on lead. And so we decided, okay, we'll move forward, deal with the asbestos problem immediately, come back and work on lead. We did that. We passed Senate Bill 705. But then it turned out, actually, in the rulemaking on Senate Bill 705, that our initial expectation that cities like Portland would be able to create their own programs and that would have a lot of latitude to enforce the program. Actually, the rulemaking showed that that was not possible and that all the enforcement had to be done through the state agency, DEQ. on a complaint-driven kind of process, which was, you know, very much unsatisfactory to us and to the city. You know, I have to say I really want to compliment Nancy Thorington for working with us on this. I know she was frustrated by it. And so we decided as we were moving forward with the attempt to include lead that we would also give cities the discretion to create their own programs. You know, the challenge here was that your colleague cities had concerns about this becoming an unfunded mandate on them to create a program such as this. And, you know, I know that you all are very jealous of your prerogatives. I would say that generally you're correct in doing so. So we set up the process so that cities could opt in to this program to the extent that they felt comfortable. And one of the things that really excites me about this process, or you know, the ordinance as I see it, is I see a real model for the rest of the state. And if City of Portland can do this right, I can certainly see other cities taking this up and taking this on, because their residents are equally concerned. So I want to thank you. I want to thank Commissioner Udaly for really putting together a good process. I will say, as we were working on Senate Bill 871, we were able to get a number of stakeholders together to bring this to consensus in the legislature. I think, I don't know if it passed unanimously, but probably pretty close to it. Your government relations staff, Dan Eisenbeiss, was just invaluable. I really want to compliment him and all the work that was done. Of course, my colleagues and Amy Beth Stevens on behalf of Speaker Kotek. And I'll turn it over to my dear colleague.
Okay, great. Thanks. I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer. I represent House District 46, which is parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. It's the first time I've testified in front of this city council in your current makeup, and it's really exciting to be here. I have had the great honor of working with my own Senator, Dembro, on a number of different toxics reductions issues. One of them I want to just mention is also reducing toxics in schools. And I know that you heard a lot about lead in the water in Portland public schools. And so when we had introduced prior legislation on reducing radon in the schools, and we were like, what? We don't test for lead? So it was really a wake-up call for us on that and a lot of different issues that we have paired up and worked on. So I came at this particular issue, asbestos and lead in demolitions, from three different places. One is I share half of his constituents, and I was hearing a lot about this. Two, I am the chair of Human Services and Housing, and so I was certainly hearing about demolitions, often from people who are very upset about demolitions and wanted to make sure that we're preserving our stock of affordable housing. So I do want to say on that note that I want to thank you for the city's support of House Bill 4007 coming up in the legislature to increase the document recording fee that goes to affordable housing. Some of that is geared toward home ownership, and some of those home ownership dollars are used not only to help people with down payments and financial education, but also for home repairs. And so the more that we can get money into home repairs so that people don't feel forced out of the affordable housing they have because they have a leaky roof or something like that, is really important. On the other hand, I'm very supportive of demolitions when it makes way for more multifamily affordable housing. We need to have more density. And so we need to do it in the safest way possible. So the third way I come to this issue is I have a public health degree and I serve on the healthcare committee. And everything that we can do to bend the cost curve and reduce costs that are related to people who get sick because of exposure to toxic chemicals is really important. So I am really delighted. We were back there just like, you know, nudging each other about all the work we do in the legislature, and then we see how the work continues in implementation, and the eagerness with which you want to implement this ordinance is really gratifying to us. So Just delighted to be here in a state-city partnership. Again, want to thank all the partners, DEQ, Oregon Health Authority, Brett Sherry, people like that who worked with the city counterparts who did a fabulous job, as well as Metro, as well as private stakeholders who were part of this. So it was a great process. I'm excited to see the product, and I can't wait for you to pass this.
Thank you. All right, next up, we have a few of our key stakeholders. Perry Cabot from Multnomah County Health, Tony Green, Deputy City Ombudsman, Mary Helen Kincaid, the former chair of DRAC, and Paul Grove from the Home Builders Association of Metro Portland. If you could all come forward, someone's going to have to bring an extra chair and make sure and state your name for the record.
And while they're getting situated, I just want to thank Michael Dembro and Alyssa Kenny-Geyer for not only being here today, because I know you're very, very busy. Thank you for your leadership down in Salem, and best of luck to you during the session, and I know we'll see lots of you. Thank you.
Welcome.
I'll start if that's okay. Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. For the record, my name is Tony Green. I'm the Deputy Ombudsman with the Office of the Ombudsman, a division of the City Auditor's Office. I'd like to thank Commissioner Udaly for inviting me to speak today and for your office's early and sustained leadership on this matter. My goal is to explain the involvement of the Ombudsman's Office and provide some additional perspective on the ordinance before you today. 14 months ago, our office received a complaint about an impending demolition in Northeast Portland. The complaint offered a wide-ranging critique of the health risks posed by demolitions and the lack of regulations in place to protect the public, especially children, from the known hazards of exposure to toxic dust. In the last 15 years, about 1,300 homes have been demolished in Portland. If they were built before 1978, more than likely they contained lead paint. And certainly they were torn down without any requirement to prevent toxic dust from contaminating neighboring properties. Prior to the ordinance before you, the city did take a step towards curbing the health risks posed by demolitions. 2 years ago, City Council adopted an ordinance that requires houses built before 1917 be deconstructed and most of the building materials salvaged for reuse. The deconstruction ordinance was primarily designed to keep construction debris out of the landfill and reduce carbon emissions, but deconstructing a house provides an additional benefit. It reduces the spread of toxic dust to neighboring properties. But for now, the ordinance only applies to houses built before 1917. That year was chosen for practical reasons. It covers the oldest housing with the most valuable building materials. It also was selected to limit the number of deconstruction projects. The Bureau of Planning and Sustainability was concerned that choosing a later date at the launch of the program might overwhelm the fledgling deconstruction industry. Choosing 1917, however, had an unintended consequence. It resulted in geographically disparate community benefits. And I'll try to explain this point using a map that should be showing up on your screen shortly.
That was short. There it is.
You got it.
Fast.
This map shows the age of housing in Portland. The darkest purple is housing built before 1917 and currently covered by the deconstruction ordinance. The lighter shade of purple is housing built from 1917 to 1930, which isn't covered now but is expected to be as the deconstruction program expands. The housing in the green areas was built since 1941. The green areas are not likely to be covered by the deconstruction ordinance in the foreseeable future. That's primarily because the quality of building materials dropped off after World War II. The deconstruction business model relies on the resale of materials, so it isn't currently economically feasible to dismantle most post-war homes. As a result, we're likely to see deconstruction occurring in the purple areas of the map and demolition occurring in the green areas. As I mentioned earlier, lead paint was banned in housing in 1978. So any house on this map, purple or green, more than likely contains lead if it were built before 1978. But only the families and children in the purple areas get protection from the deconstruction ordinance. And as you can see, they fall overwhelmingly in affluent and gentrifying neighborhoods. By contrast, families and children living in that big green area east of Interstate 205 will continue to be exposed to toxic dust stirred up by demolitions. When our office discovered this disparity last spring, we recommended that the city adopt regulations to contain dust during demolitions. All families and all children should be protected from exposure to lead. Of course, this is much easier said than done. At least 9 federal, state, and local agencies have some jurisdiction over demolitions and or lead. Each brings a different focus, but none comprehensively addresses the release of toxic dust during residential demolitions. To make matters more challenging, very few jurisdictions around the country have even attempted to address toxic dust suppression during demolitions. There is no model ordinance to borrow and easily adapt to the pattern and volume of demolitions in Portland. To overcome the regulatory and governance gap, our office recommended that the Bureau of Development Services and the Multnomah County Health Department jointly tackle the problem. The ordinance before you today is the result of the cooperative effort of city and county staff, leadership and commitment to health equity from Commissioner Udaly's office, as well as Senate Bill 871 directing the Oregon Health Authority to develop best practices for containing lead dust during demolitions. This ordinance is a vital step in protecting all children and neighborhoods from the toxic and potentially devastating consequences of lead exposure. It is also a model that other cities in Oregon and beyond can look to. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd like to turn it over now to Perry Cabot with the Multnomah County Health Department.
Tony. Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. For the record, my name is Perry Cabot. I'm a senior program specialist with the Multnomah County Environmental Health Services Program within the Public Health Division. I serve as Multnomah County's subject matter expert on lead and lead poisoning prevention. I'm pleased to be here today in support of the city's efforts to protect our community from the impacts of toxic lead dust generated during mechanical demolition of older homes. The dangers of the heavy metal lead are well known and understood. Ben Franklin wrote in 1786 of the, quote, baneful particles and qualities of lead. And yet, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, approximately 500,000 children in the U.S. today have blood lead levels at or above the CDC's current public health action level. Lead-based pain in older homes is the leading cause of childhood lead poisoning in the nation. There is no safe level of lead in our blood, and the neurological and cognitive impacts of even low-level exposures are well documented. Recent studies show that mechanical demolition of lead paint-containing structures may disperse lead dust as far as 300 feet from the worksite. And yet, as I speak to you today, there are no rules in Oregon, and few in the nation, requiring demolition contractors to take steps to control the release of fugitive lead dust from demolition projects. Over the last 5 years in Multnomah County, there were 291 confirmed lead poisoning cases in children under 18 years of age. More than 50% of those cases were determined after environmental investigation to be caused by lead-based paint or dust. While federal and state rules were enacted almost a decade ago to reduce lead poisonings due to renovation and painting projects in older housing, demolitions were not covered by these rules and remain an activity with the potential to contaminate the environment where we live, work, and play. The ordinance before you today is among the first and finest of its kind in the nation. It is the result of a year-long, highly collaborative process across multiple agencies and involving key stakeholders with diverse perspectives. Multnomah County is pleased to be a partner in this work, and we welcome the enhanced public health protections born of these efforts. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Mary Helen Kincaid, and today's the first day I can say publicly former chair of DRAC. My terms ran out, and also today is the 8th anniversary of when I retired and became busier than when I worked. It's been interesting to me to sit through. I sat through the LTIC as well as this, and to hear the different perspectives and the people and the community involvement. And so I don't want to take issue with what anybody said, but when they say that bureaus and agencies tasked with handling this issue with demolitions and dust, it was really the citizens that started it. It wasn't government. It wasn't regulations. And When I was the chair of DRAC, and back in March of 2014, several citizens, and I'm going to call her out because she was the one that really took me aback, Kimberly Kohler from Eastmoreland, was aghast that right across the street from school, a house had been demolished. And she literally grabbed my shirt and said, "You have to do something about this." So she was a part of the group, United Neighbors for Reform. John Sandy's here today. And that started a whole interesting dialogue. It began a conversation because I, being part of BDS, had to be informed that handling demolitions and permitting, but they didn't have control over the lead and asbestos handling. And so I said, let's get those people, who are they? And worked with Nancy Thornton and tried to get those people together, and it was kind of a nightmare trying to find all these people because there was no conglomerate of people to handle this issue. And as Perry mentioned, that it's a wide and varied group. There are way more than 9 or 10 agencies. I started calling DEQ, started calling EPA, sort of got nowhere. Unfortunately, in North Portland in the Kenton Firehouse, where Representative Kotek has her office, so I spoke with her staff, Amy Beth, I don't know if she's still back there, but she was back there, and said, how do I get a hold of somebody that can do something? I was shocked that the next day around noon, Audrey O'Brien from DEQ, as head of inspections, called and said, what do you need? And I thought, wow, that really worked really well. but I was also shocked that there was no way to bring those people together. We had a meeting, I wrote the date down here, October 20th, 2014, 19 people showed up at BDS. They got us a room, and most of the people had something in common. EPA at that time gives their jurisdictional handling of hazmat materials to DEQ, and then they farm that out. So at that first meeting, there were many people that are not in the room today, but came to be a part of that meeting. Nancy Thornton worked with OHA and Perry, and the group continued on. But I think had not Kimberly spoken to me and the citizens did something, we wouldn't be here today. So I really want to emphasize that part. John Sandy from UNR worked very closely with Mike Dembro's office because that was at the state regulation. And it was a little, I would say it's hard for citizens because those processes ran parallel. And I think this whole process is indicative of how even UNR and DRAC don't agree on all things, but we work together to get this process through. So I think this, more than anything, shows that good work can come of sometimes contentious meetings. I really applaud the effort and was glad to be a part of it. I also wanted to recognize Logan Giles from Mike Dembro's office. He was instrumental in bringing people together to meet. And the EPA, for all the bureaucracy and stuff we hear today, I forget the woman's name, but she was very helpful in providing direction of federal regulations, state regulations, that sort of thing.
I think it was Nina. Wasn't it Nina?
Pardon?
Nina.
Yeah, I think, is that?
Kim Barnum.
Oh, Kim Barnum, okay. We were able to address a number of issues that people had. There was a good result from all of it. And I wanted to comment because I made a note. Organizational bureaucratic setbacks, there were a ton of those. But I really want to applaud all those agencies for coming together to do that. And it was also informational. The other comment that I just wanted to make in regard to this, I don't have the ordinance in front of me, but you were talking about getting it implemented as soon as possible. I think in the amendment, if you just said implement by July 1st, so that's a drop dead date, but if you do it next week, you know, if you walk out there and somebody walks up and said, hey, I can do this, that might be a possibility just to put that word in, and then it won't hold back a set date. Because I know there's great anxiety that why can't we do it sooner? I'm going to go back to organizational bureaucratic stumbling blocks. But I want to applaud everybody that worked on this and my fellow members of the DRAC subcommittee because they recognized that this was important and not necessarily in our mission statement. There were three different commissioners in charge of the Bureau through this process, and all were very agreeable to the work that we did, even though it didn't specifically speak to permits. It spoke to the work that the BDS does. So thank you, and I guess most of all, I think the city should take credit for the citizens bringing something forward.
Well, thank you, Mary Helen, for your leadership throughout this process from 2014 on, and I know that Commissioner Saltzman joins me in thanking Commissioner Udaly for bringing it over the finish line, but I also thank you. My understanding is that the Development Re-Advisory Committee voted unanimously in support of this proposal. Is that correct?
Yes.
So that in itself is a major accomplishment, and I appreciate all that work.
And they were actually, quite involved with the discussions of how this could best work.
Yeah. And then in the spirit of giving credit where due and the United Neighbourhoods for Reform, the map that was shown by the Deputy Ombudsman, it was mostly neighbours in the purple areas who were doing the advocacy on this. And so it's an example of how you would think that the homeowners who were some of the major participants were able to put their time in, and it then benefits the whole system, including people in areas where they maybe have less opportunity to go to neighbourhood and city council meetings. So it was really, it was a citizen-driven thing, and it's taken a lot of people to get it done. Thank you, Mary Helen.
Thank you for the record, Paul Grove with the Portland Metro Home Building Association. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today with respect to the implementation of Senate Bill 871. I'd echo a lot of Mary Helen's comments. I'm kind of new to this game and this issue, but from my perspective and the perspective of the association, it was very collaborative. The input was indeed meaningful, and that started really, from my perspective, from the top down, and kudos to Commissioner Udaly and her office. Marshall took a great deal of time and effort to come in, to talk, to walk through things, and seek members' input, not just through the association, but through DRAC and elsewhere. And as the process continued and unfolded, a lot of kudos to BDS, from Rebecca to Nancy to others. It was very much, again, meaningful input, and I can't tell you how much that goes in terms of policy development to be able to have that feedback, dissected and debated, and whether incorporated or not, know that it's a welcome ear at the end of the day. And so that allowed us to get to a comfort level with this. And then at the end of the day, I think, moving forward with prospective policy proposals, I think using DRAC as that vehicle to vet, to seek input, it's a great cross-section of neighborhood developers and others that bring unique perspectives to policy development. I think it's a tool that can be further realized on other matters moving forward, unfortunately without Mary Helen at the table. But nonetheless, I know she will still be present. So so thank you very much for the opportunity. It's nice to be a part of an invited panel for a change. So thank you.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you all, four of you. Thank you, Mary Helen, for your great leadership. We appreciate it.
It's been fun. But I have more fun things to do.
I was going to say there's plenty of fun to be had yet.
I was just glad I wasn't here yesterday.
I know. And Representative Kenny Geyer said this was the first time she testified in front of city council. In front of this city council, you haven't really gotten the full welcome yet, so we'll have to invite you back on a different day, perhaps on Wednesday morning.
Wednesday morning, yeah.
Yeah.
So we now have public testimony.
Very good. Carla, how many folks do we have signed up for public testimony?
We have three people signed up.
Very good, folks. 3 minutes, name for the record.
Please come up. John Sandy, Margaret Davis, and Ramona Runkle.
How are you today?
Doing fine, thank you.
Good, excellent. Why don't you start us off, please? Name for the record, 3 minutes. When the red light goes off, your time is up.
Good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. My name is John Sandy. I'm a resident of Northeast Portland, and I'm also a member of United Neighborhoods for Reform, UNR. About just over 3 years ago, United Neighborhoods for Reform presented to City Council a proposal or a resolution backed by over 40 neighborhoods that dealt with concerns around new development infill as well as responsible practices during demolitions of existing houses. The ensuing years of UNR enlisting community, city bureau and administration, as well as state legislative support, as obvious from previous speakers, has resulted in the proposal that we are discussing today. UNR is encouraged by and supports this proposal, albeit with some further discussion on a few points. The city proposal is modeled after Senate Bill 871, Best Practices Advisory Group, which included statewide representatives from the many stakeholders involved in residential demolition activities. As a member of this advisory group, I was encouraged by the broad support of developers and construction companies who recognized that these practices would help level the playing field between companies striving to be responsible and those not so much. Since compliance is key to effectiveness of any ordinance, proper inspections and meaningful penalties are a must. Therefore, the quicker, as has been mentioned, the quicker the proposed additional inspectors are trained and performing their duties, the better. And echoing some other comments, you and I would hope that accelerating a target from July 1st should be a priority within BDS. In addition, the proposal only requires, and Nancy Thornton made some comments on this, only requires pre- and post-demolition inspection, but states that inspections during the actual demolition itself may occur. Since this would be the most critical inspection point, the ambiguity within the code language is of some concern. But as I've talked with Nancy, BDS personnel have indicated this ambiguity will be clarified through administration rules, and we will hold them accountable to that commitment. UNR has lobbied for the notification area to be expanded to 400 feet rather than 150 feet as the proposal states, as the 400-foot distance represents the extent of potential significant lead dust fallout as determined by a number of studies. The argument that 150 feet is adequate with implementation of this best practice ordinance only holds up if the demonstrated compliance is near or at 100%. Therefore, this should be a performance measurement tracked by BDS and available to the public. Also noted within both the SB 871 recommendations and the city best practices proposal is the use of full deconstruction as a means of removing residential structure. I'm just finishing up. UNR continues to advocate for this method to be the preferred choice for any and all residential demolitions, regardless of the date of construction, as construction material suppliers cannot guarantee that asbestos-containing materials will never be imported and find their way into American homes. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm Margaret Davis. I've worked with United Neighborhoods for Reform and also the Roseway Neighborhood Association, but today I'm really talking for all the Portlanders like me who have experienced and will experience a demolition within 400 feet. Anti-demolition activists have long sounded the alarm on the release of hazardous materials during demolitions, and here at least since 2014. Thank you to everyone who helped craft this public health and safety measure. However, I call your attention to the proposal's exemption for unsafe and hazardous structures. That's at 24.55.205C8, under which certain demolitions would not have to follow the lead hazard reduction requirements. If a structure to be demolished is deemed unsafe and hazardous, then its owner should provide expanded notice to neighbors that corresponds to the increased dispersal of hazardous materials. Well-known studies, including the major and recent HUD analysis, show that most hazmat fallout from a demolition occurs within 300 feet of a demolition. It's not until 400 feet that measured particulates return to background levels. If we only ask for a notification to neighbors within 150 feet of the demolition site, we're protecting less than half of the people and properties that will be exposed. I actually have a little graphic to show you. John's going to hold it up. So if each of these lines represents 100 feet, we're just about here in our notice. And if we're not applying any measures to mitigate, we'll be spreading it all the way out. In meetings of the DRAC subcommittee, I've brought up these statistics, but committee members say expanded notice costs too much. Whatever the expense of expanded notification, I am sure it is less than tutoring for a kid with developmental disabilities or managing illness or brain damage brought about by ingesting lead and or asbestos. Please add expanded notification to neighbors living within 300, ideally 400, feet from a demolition if a building is deemed unsafe and hazardous. Otherwise, ironically, unsafe and hazardous will refer to anyone living, playing, breathing within that 400 feet. Finally, please keep on applying the pressure to move up that effective date. We've discussed this basic public health protection for years, and even moving up this date by a few weeks, months, will protect thousands more people from known toxins. Also, don't forget, the cheapest, greenest building is the one already standing. This week, I've looked up Craigslist. There's almost a thousand listings in one day for rentals. So we've gone from a housing crisis to a housing glut with units going vacant and a lot of people really wishing for those cheaper, well-built houses that were put in the landfill. Coming back to this topic, hopefully we will see the futility, the expense, and unnecessary loss involved in demolitions and stop them altogether, keeping our viable, affordable housing and building only on vacant land. So again, expanded notification for demolitions that are exempted, and for the love of Portland and its people, move up that effective date. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Davis, thank you so much for your leadership over the years. You've put a lot of effort into this.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Ramona Runkle. I'm 11 years old. I live in a very old house across the street from Unthink Park. And when I was 8 months old, I had an elevated lead level of, 6 micrograms per deciliter? I might be pronouncing that wrong, but I'm probably not. My mom took me to get tested for lead poisoning. She took me to the Josiah Hill III Clinic, which no longer exists. If I had even just a little more lead in my blood than 6 micrograms per deciliter, I could have suffered from permanent social learning and social disabilities, as well as a plethora of other health problems. But my parents took the steps needed to make our house safe for me, and my lead level quickly dropped to undetected. Passing this ordinance would make it possible for other kids to be safe from lead paint, which is terrible for brains and for blood. And this ordinance is very important so other kids don't get sick and get developmentally disabled. This is a good ordinance and it should be passed. That's all I have to
all
say.
All right. Well said.
Cut to the chase.
Right.
Good job.
Ramona, is this your first? Have you testified here before?
No.
You have done an outstanding job. Thank you.
Can we suspend the rules?
Yes. Rules are suspended.
In case anyone is wondering, that is the daughter of my chief of staff, Marshall Runkle, and his lovely wife, Mel.
Thought I saw a resemblance.
Yes.
Carla, is there anybody else signed up for public testimony?
So I have a couple amendments I'd like to make. Number one, I might need a little bit of help. I regret that we couldn't move this forward months ago. Obviously, we needed something to change the state level before we could really do this at the local level. And I agree that we should move as quickly as possible, although I can't guarantee that we can move much faster than 5 months. But as Mary Helen suggested, we could certainly change the language under therefore item G. It currently says this ordinance will take effect on July 1st, 2018, if we change it to by July 1st, 2018, does that allow us to kick into gear if we are able to hire the needed staff?
Commissioner Udaly, there are certain provisions of this ordinance that kick in on the effective date. So, for example, in under the therefore clause in D, there are fee increases that go into effect. And then in E, there's a fee and penalty schedule that goes into effect on the effective date. So for those reasons, you need a firm effective date when the ordinance will go into effect. And to say sometime between now and July would not give that firm date to say when the fees would go into effect, for example. So what you could do is, I think, amend G to read, this ordinance shall take effect 30 days after passage,